Support for MPB comes from the Mississippi Museum of Art in Jackson. What Became of Dr. Smith by artist Noah Satterstrom is on view now through September 22, 2024. Learn more at msmuseumart.org.
This podcast is a local production of Mississippi Public Broadcasting. It's made possible in part by contributions from podcast listeners. Please consider making a contribution by going to the Donate Now tab at mpbonline.org. Thanks for your financial support.
Welcome to the Mississippi Arts Hour on MPB Think Radio, where each week we talk with creative Mississippians. I'm your host, Kristen Brandt, Arts Industry Director at the Mississippi Arts Commission. And today, to celebrate National Poetry Month, our guest is Todd Osborne. Todd is a poet based in Hattiesburg who is passing an exciting milestone in his literary career. We will discuss Todd's forthcoming debut poetry collection, Gatherer, when you tune in to this segment of the Mississippi Arts Hour. Todd, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
Well, we're glad to have you as well. You grew up in Nashville, right?
I did, yes.
What trajectory landed you here putting down roots in Hattiesburg?
That's a great question. I grew up born and raised just outside of Nashville. I think purists would want me to say Antioch specifically, but grew up there, went to college there, and then when I was going to get my master's, I wanted to study creative writing more in depth, and I ended up getting accepted at Oklahoma State University, which is in Stillwater, Oklahoma. I always tell people accurately named. Not a lot happens. And then after my MFA, I wanted a PhD, and I knew that the University of Southern Mississippi was a good program, and I ended up in Hattiesburg. And sort of from there, met my wife, settled down, and it's, you know, the rest is history, I guess.
Well, there's a lot of really great poets in Hattiesburg. Yes. I guess you know Angela Ball.
Yes, love Angela. She's great.
Well, so when you were growing up in Nashville, when did you start getting into writing, and was that something that you've always had with you?
Yeah, I think from a young age, I loved reading and writing. I remember, you know, in kindergarten, I was not a good artist, but I would try and do like little comic books, right? Like little superhero stories. And then I kept writing up until like basically the rest of my childhood. I wrote little stories, or, you know, like I think there was an era where I was writing spy novels that were maybe like 7 pages, but I was like, this is so long. How could anyone read this? And then eventually when I got to college, I started studying creative writing more in depth. And I really thought I was going to be the next like great American novelist. I was like, I will be the next Faulkner, the next Hemingway. And my creative writing teacher said, you know, you're better at poetry. And I looked at him and I was like, oh. And so I started taking more of an interest in poetry. And I, you know, I loved poetry. Even in high school, I was that weird kid that was like, I remember trying to memorize the love song of J. Alfred Prufrock and reading Keats and like trying to almost like decipher, oh, this word rhymes with this word. Like from, you know, being a teenager, which is, I think, probably atypical for most teenagers. But yeah, in college, I just kept writing and fell in love.
It's always so fascinating the ways that, you know, you can come in to an experience and know where you want to go and then get this piece of feedback that totally changes your horizon line there.
Yes, completely. Yeah.
Professors and teachers can be really poised to be that role for a student. And mm-hmm. You teach now, right?
I do. Yes. I teach high school. I teach in Marion County, which is about 45 minutes away from where I live, which is not bad. And I love it. I love that aspect of getting to help students figure out like who they are or what they want to do. Yeah, it's such a rewarding part of it.
Do you ever share your writing with your students?
I do occasionally, at my own peril.
That's really brave. Teenagers can be very mean.
They can. Most of the students that I've told that I am, you know, a poet, they're like, oh, okay. And they just move on. They're not super interested in it. But yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see if they react to me having a book out.
Well, you'll have to have a classroom copy for them.
Yes, that's true. I've had a copy. I got an early copy about a month ago, and I've had it just sort of sitting on my desk. And a couple students have been like, wait a second. But mostly they're too busy looking at their phones and talking about what's going on at school.
And I recall when, you know, I was going through high school, the teachers that made the biggest impact on me were my English teachers. And there are some of them that I still talk to. One of them is also a poet, Jamie Dixon.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And so I think that, you know, making that connection with them makes your relationship potentially last longer.
Yeah, definitely. And there, you know, especially now with like social media, it feels like you can be connected with your students. Obviously, when they are your students, no social media contact.
No.
But afterwards, I have some students that graduated last year, and I'm just getting to see what they're up to in college. Whether it's like, oh, I stayed up till 4 a.m. writing a paper, or things are going great for me. It's kind of nice to get that continuity with them.
So you're teaching. How do you manage to find and fit time for writing with the other demands you have?
It's really hard. Mostly, I just try and write whenever I can. If a line comes to me or a phrase or an idea, I'll just write it down in my phone really quickly and then either come back to it later, like if I have a day off or on a weekend. But for the most part, you kind of just have to figure it out, you know, whenever you can.
And when you're getting started with a new poem, are you kind of writing by hand? Are you typing it in on your phone? I remembered one of the pieces that you have in Gatherer. You mentioned scribbling down on sticky notes.
Yes. I think, yes, the sticky notes, that's definitely more, for me at least, a process that you do, like, when all the poems are done. It's not like you are, I'm not writing on paper as much as I feel like I probably should. I'm usually either typing it on a computer or into my phone and then trying to figure it out on the sort of digital page. I know a lot of poets still really love handwriting, and it's just never been like something that I gravitated towards as a writer.
Well, and something I think is so interesting about poetry is you get to play with formatting more than most writers do with screenwriting and playwriting. If you don't follow the specific format, the actors won't know what to do. So with poetry, you kind of get to have this one-on-one relationship with the reader, and you get to play with where the words are on the page.
Yeah, I think that's totally right. And it's one of the reasons for me, handwriting never really made sense for poetry, because I'm very much fixated on like the line and how each line is going to look as a finished product. And when I handwrite, my handwriting is so sloppy. So it's like one line, I might write it and it goes all the way to the end of the page. But when I type it, it's like not at all. And so I've written these lines that, you know, in my hand look one way and then typed are totally different. And so I think I got fed up with that. And so I was like, I'm going to cut out the middleman, go straight to typing. And it just, for me, streamlines the process.
How do you decide what a poem looks like?
I think you have to let the poem speak to you. And this also changes a lot in revision. Like how a poem looks originally might be totally different from how it looks later on. You know, do you want to do like quatrains or couplets or just one long stanza? It's sort of, to me, I always think that those questions work best when you're thinking about what the poem is trying to do or what it's trying to say. I don't want to just put a poem into like couplets because that's what I've been doing. I want it to feel like there's a reason for it to be in couplets.
Well, and you have some poems that kind of loop, kind of like pantomimes or villanelles, but mm-hmm. they don't follow the same stanza format.
Yeah.
What kind of attracts you to that style?
I really love form. I love that in poetry, it's, you know, one of those forms where, or like in poetry, you have forms, like received forms, like a pantomime, like a sonnet, which I love a lot. And being able to play with that and have this repetition really makes you pay attention to the line. And I think those poems specifically, the ones that I'm thinking of are what are called Markov sonnets, which is a received form that is from the Palestinian-American poet George Abraham. And they sort of came up with this form. And I am not I think they were getting like an advanced degree in science of some sort. So it's based on this idea of like repeating like atoms or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I just thought it was such an interesting form. And I was playing with, you know, these different ideas. One of them's about how I moved around from Nashville to Oklahoma to Mississippi. And the other one was about Mississippi adopting a new state flag, which is so much about like the way that these like cycles of history repeat. And so it made sense to me for those forms to, or for those poems to take the form of this kind of stretched out sonnet where it's still technically 14 lines, but the 14 lines are repeated in these very interesting ways.
No, I got this kind of sense of the ocean when I was reading it. It felt like a cycle. It felt like something that wasn't going to stop. And then when it did stop, I was like, closure.
Yeah.
It was nice. Mm-hmm. Like it was ready in time to let go. Mm-hmm. And I think that's another part of, you know, being a writer, being an artist in general, knowing when that stopping point is and when you're done editing and when you're done writing on a specific piece. Can you tell me a little bit about your process and when you know a poem is finished?
I think sometimes you don't know. But I think usually for me, at least, when it feels like the poem has said what it needs to say. And sometimes I write a poem and I'm like, oh, it said everything. And then I go back and I realize, oh, it's maybe said too much. Like there's so often that like in revision, you come back and you realize, oh, I could have trimmed this down, or maybe I need to expand on this. It's not saying enough. For me, I always really pay attention to how a poem begins and how it ends, because I do think those are like the most impactful moments for the reader. Obviously, you want the whole poem to be strong. But if you can have a really powerful beginning and a really powerful ending, like the perfect image or the perfect idea or word to end on, that does a lot. And so when I feel like I've found that is when I say, okay, I can't do it any better. Got to stop right here.
Were there any in your collection, Gatherer, that were hard to find that end point that you kept going back to?
Oh, that's a good question. Yes, I think, and now I'm like, what did I write in this book? It's been such an interesting process. I'm thinking of, there's this poem near the end of the collection called A Love Poem, which is actually a poem, and I can't talk about it too much because I will get, I might cry. It is a poem about my wife's cat that I got to be in the life with. And the final lines are these lines that are probably the oldest lines in the book. But the poem is very recent. Like, I think it's one of the last poems I wrote. And when I got to the end, I was like, well, I need something else here. And I remember this, like, line and a half that I'd written over 10 years ago in Oklahoma. And I was like, oh, I think that's it. I think those lines need to go here. Like, it's such a great way to encapsulate what I'm trying to say here. So there's things like that where, like, you have these lines that I for sure thought that those lines would never show up again. They were part of a dead poem I'd moved on from, and then I was like, oh, wait, we can breathe new life into them. Like, nobody knows that this is from a poem that didn't work. So
I won't tell anyone.
Yeah, don't tell anyone. This isn't going out, right? This is just us.
Just between the two of us.
Okay, good.
So with Gatherer, you have a collection of poems, and this is being your debut collection. The first time that you've gotten to kind of order what you've written, was there a logic to going into putting the specific poems in that sequence?
Yeah, I think you always want to put them in a way that, like, makes sense. So, like, one poem sort of naturally leads into another. There are some poems in here that sort of, like, talk to each other. So there's a couple of poems called A History of Gardening, and they're, like, it's a paired poem. So I knew those two would go next to each other. And there's some other examples like that. But for the most part, I sort of like took the sticky note and I would write, you know, like the first line and the last line of a poem and see how are there like conversations between different poems? Are there things that they're saying to each other? Does one poem sort of refer back to another poem? And do I want to put that poem first or second? There's like this sort of interesting thing. I think it's interesting where I refer to another poem in the collection, but the reference to the poem comes before the poem that I'm referring to, which to me is like a way of showing like, yeah, these were all written at different times. But in the experience of reading it, you're sort of getting this like almost timeless quality.
A synthesis.
Yeah, a synthesis. I think that's a good way to think of it. All the poems are coming together, and it's like, if you could read them all at the same time, that would be great. But we can't do that, so I put them in this order.
Hi, I'm Lauren Rhodes. You are listening to the podcast version of the Mississippi Arts Hour. The Arts Hour is a co-production of the Mississippi Arts Commission and MPB Think Radio. You can also listen to the show on Think Radio every Sunday afternoon at 5. To have access to all Arts Hour interviews, subscribe to the podcast using your favorite podcasting app.
Join us each week for Everyday Tech on MPB Think Radio. We have an IT expert, a computer repair ace, and we troubleshoot your problems on the phones as well. Everyday Tech, Wednesdays at 10 on MPB Think Radio. Download the podcast now or listen on YouTube on the MPB Think Radio channel.
Welcome back to the Mississippi Arts Hour on MPB Think Radio. I'm Kristen Brandt, Arts Industry Director at the Mississippi Arts Commission, and today I'm talking with poet Todd Osborne. Welcome back, Todd.
Thank you.
So we were talking a little bit before the break about this being your first poetry collection.
Yes.
And how you've done a lot of work with journals in the past. Some of these have been published in journals.
Yeah.
What was the difference in the publishing process between submitting an individual poem to a journal versus pitching a collection to a publisher?
Right. Usually, I mean, for both of them, it's a lot of hope, a lot of sending it out. I sort of think, and it's not fun to hear, but it's sort of a numbers game. Like, for a lot of these things, if you feel good about your, like, what you are writing, if you know that if you're getting positive feedback from peers or mentors, you kind of just have to send it out. And that's a really hard thing to do. I think the first time I sent out a poem to be rejected was over 10 years ago now. And you kind of just have to keep doing it and then hope that people find your work that appreciate it. The big difference between like an individual poem or like usually you're sending out like a packet of poems. And the big difference is that, you know, if you've got a book, then you know probably that at least some of these poems are good. They've been published before. Somebody thought, oh yeah, this is worth sending out into the world. And so I think it gives you a little more confidence. And there were a lot of moments before, Bell Point Press found the book, where I was like a semi-finalist or someone was like, oh, we like this, but it wasn't a right fit at this time. So I knew the collection was close, and I thought, you know, it was sort of funny. I was part of an anthology that Bell Point put out, and the editor, Casey, just said, like, hey, if anyone has a collection, send it, and I'll, you know, look at it. And so I was like, well, I'll send it and see what happens. And she loved the collection, which was I feel so grateful for. So everybody has like a totally different way that they get to their first book and their second book, I assume. Yeah.
Well, so you kind of approached with this collection already put together. Was there a lot of editing once you had already kind of made your pitch and been accepted?
There was an editing process. Casey had really good notes. It was, you know, some of the poems are like very idiosyncratic and like the way that they use punctuation, or, you know, Casey would just be like, hey, do you want to do this or this? And I would be like, oh, yeah, that's a good idea. Or, no, actually, I like it how it is. But it was a very, genial process. Like, hopefully, if you have an editor that, you know, gets what you're doing, they are going to help make the collection stronger.
Do you have plans for a book tour following the release?
Not like a full, you know, nationwide book tour. I don't know if the market is ready for nationwide poetry tours.
But the Mississippi Independent Book Circuit is strong.
Is strong, yes. And I'm very excited about it. Yes, I am going to be all over, up and down Mississippi throughout April. On the 5th, I'm going to be in the Delta reading as part of the Delta Arts Alliance. I'm doing a hometown reading in Hattiesburg on the 13th. Bell Point Press is actually going to be at the New Orleans Poetry Festival the weekend of April 20th. And then on the 27th, I'll be back up here in Jackson doing a signing at Lemuria, which I'm very excited about.
Great. Well, we'll have to catch up with you
again
at Lemuria. So you were talking a little bit in the last segment about incorporating some of your personal experiences into poems. I think about your wife's cat and kind of having that be part of your life.
Yeah.
How do you feel that your personal experiences get worked into your poems?
Honestly, I am still struggling with writing a poem that isn't about a personal experience for me. That's not always the case. Some of my poems, especially in this collection, are sort of like tinged through the lens of like history or different stories. There's one about, you know, I have like some poems that are sort of ekphrastic in nature. So they're about like artworks, or there's one about the Firefall photo, which is this like really sort of strange photo of people kicking a campfire over a waterfall. And it makes it look like the waterfall is on fire. And so I was like, oh, that's so strange. And I like did some research on it and it became a poem. But so many of the poems in here are about my life or about, you know, my growing up. I was talking with my mom the other day and she had just read it. And she said, I can't tell if you love or hate that you grew up in the South. And I said, well, it's not really either one. First of all, me and my wife looked at each other and said, well, we bought a house in Hattiesburg. So we have made a decision one way or the other. But it's more about like recognizing what it means to grow up in the South. Like it's such a specific region. And I couldn't write poems and not be like, hey, this is kind of weird that, you know, people would put on white masks and burn crosses. Like that's strange, right? And yeah, not to like, I'm not like out here to make a big statement that has not, you know, racism is bad or, you know, bigotry shouldn't be, but yeah, it's sort of me reflecting on what it is meant to grow up.
Well, and when it's part of the terroir, when it's in the soil where you grow up, it, right. It kind of informs your experience in a way, and you have to reflect. And I think poetry is so great in the way that it encourages that reflection. Yeah. And, you know, finding the right words and the right feelings and putting those two things together to try to make somebody else see it too.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Yep. It's such like a hard balance to walk because you don't want it to ever come off as like pedantic or like trying to shove something down someone's throat. You're hoping that like the hope is that, yes, the right words or the right image will help someone like see something in a way they hadn't considered before.
Are there any kind of recurring symbols or motifs in this collection for readers to be on the lookout for?
Well, I mean, so this is like there was a version of this book that had a lot more poems with the title A History of Blank that shows up several times in the collection as it is. And I think my thought when I was writing those was, well, everything has a history, right? And like something that might just be a story from my childhood is a kind of history. So that idea of history pops up a lot. Especially like U.S. history, you know, there's like everyone from like Rutherford B. Hayes to antebellum mansions pop up, and then also Clay Aiken. So like there's just a bunch of like weird different like figures from history, but also just like things that are themselves symbols that appear. And I think there's also a lot of I think if you are an eagle-eyed reader with a history in the evangelical church, a lot of the language might sound familiar to you. The title is actually taken from this translation of the author of, or the sort of name that the author of Ecclesiastes gives for themselves, which is often like interpreted or translated as like the preacher or the teacher. But I was looking at it, and there was a version of it that said the gatherer. And I thought, well, that's such an interesting way to think about, like, what poetry is. You're gathering up all of these experiences and ideas and images and sort of giving them to the world.
And that distillation really comes through your own particular lens. Do you ever have any difficulty when you're writing a poem kind of expressing your own original voice within the constraints of a defined form, you know, where a stanza is supposed to follow these specific requirements in order to be a this poem?
Yeah. I think for me, the most interesting thing about form is the way that you can break it. If it is a received form, it's a sonnet or it's a pantoum or a guzzle or any of these forms, the interesting thing for me is not necessarily like, oh, you did a sonnet so well, but what is it about this poem that sort of expands what our idea of a sonnet is? There's a poem in here called Epithalamium for Pandemic Wedding, which is about me and my wife who got married in the summer of 2020, and there's so much to say about that specifically, but we had these plans for a big wedding, and then we curtailed them so that we could get married. And it started as a sonnet. And if you look in the collection, there's 14 lines, and then it keeps going. Because the poem, like so many things in that time period, like could not be, you know, pinned in by just a simple 14 lines. Yeah.
Do you feel like the pandemic had an impact on writing these poems?
Very much so. This is not like, I don't want to say this is a pandemic book. A lot of these poems predate the pandemic. But there are also a lot of poems, especially poems about teaching, that sort of reference what it was like to teach during that first full pandemic year. It was very stressful. It was very scary. You know, my wife taught with me for a semester in the same school, and we were both just constantly like, are we going to get sick? What's going to happen? So, yeah, it's hard not to have that influence, you know, the collection in some way. And I, you know, I'm not grateful for the pandemic, but, you know, the poems that came out of it, I think, were good poems. Yeah.
You don't have to be grateful to the pandemic. Yeah, I'm gonna release you from that guilt.
I already regret saying that, so don't pull that one out. That's not a pull quote, right?
No, we'll be fine. We'll be fine. Did any of the poems in this collection pose like a unique challenge to you or stretch your abilities in a way that you weren't expecting?
One of my favorite poems, and it's such a weird poem that I think it was, I never got it published because it's like, it ends up being about five or six pages long. It's called Promise Dart, and it is a sort of more recent form called a pachakcha, which is based on a presentation style that came from an architecture firm based in Tokyo. And the poet Terence Hayes, who was such a great poet, took this form and basically said, like, okay, we're going to do a kind of ekphrastic poem with 20 stanzas, and each stanza has its own, like, artwork as its header, like as a title. And so I did that with the artist Damien Hirst, who's mostly known for these, like, very strange, like, I don't know if you'd call them sculptures. His most famous one is called The Physical Impossibility of Death in the Mind of Someone Living. And it's just a tiger shark in a formaldehyde box, basically. And he put it in like a London museum and said, like, all right, this is art. And people were like, what? This is art? And he sort of has this like provocateur kind of persona to him. But I had a grandfather who had tragically passed away with dementia. And it was really... you know, like, it was really sad. It was, like, one of my first sort of brushes with death when I was in high school, or maybe it was college. What is time? But that was a hard poem to write because you have to, there is this form where there's only 20 stanzas. You can only use, like, 4 to 5 lines. But I'm trying to convey the, like, depth of this, like, very tragic scenario in a way that is still, like, poetic and isn't merely, like, telling a story, if that makes sense.
And I think it's so difficult, especially when you're writing poems about grief, that you feel like you have to encapsulate so much.
Yeah.
I feel like I've been in that experience before, and I don't consider myself a writer, but any time that I go through something big, like the loss of someone in my life, that's something that I look for, is what is the art that can help me understand what I'm going through.
Yeah. And I think that's so important, is to have these things in your life that can reflect back to you, like, this is okay, what you're feeling is normal. You know, grief is one of those things that everyone's going to experience. So to have art that can reflect that back to you is really important.
Hi, I'm Lauren Rhodes. You are listening to the podcast version of the Mississippi Arts Hour. The Arts Hour is a co-production of the Mississippi Arts Commission and MPB Think Radio. You can also listen to the show on Think Radio every Sunday afternoon at 5. To have access to all Arts Hour interviews, subscribe to the podcast using your favorite podcasting app. When you look at your vehicle, think of MPB. Need to get rid of your ride? Donate it by calling 877-MPB, the number 4, CAR. Need to have some work done on your truck? Listen to AutoCorrect Thursdays at 10, Saturdays at 11. An MPB license plate reminds you that MPB is with you wherever you go. Go to your county office and ask for an MPB car tag. MPB and CARS, better together.
You're listening to Mississippi Arts Hour on MPB Think Radio. I'm Kristen Brandt from the Mississippi Arts Commission, and today I'm talking with poet Todd Osborne.
Hello.
I'm glad you're back. And we're actually going to have a little treat here because Todd's going to read one of his poems from his poetry collection, Gatherer.
Thank you so much. Yes, I'm going to read one of the poems we talked about earlier. It is a Markov sonnet, and it is called State Flag. In 1894, some decisions were made by white men having nothing and everything to do with today. Mississippi wears its bloody history on its sleeve. Having nothing and everything to do with today, Mississippi wears its bloody history on its sleeve, thumbing its nose at its citizens. We give a finger back. Mississippi wears its bloody history on its sleeve, thumbing our nose at it. Citizens, we give a finger back. Silent for years, the state finally decides to speak, thumbing a nose at its citizens who give a finger back. Silent for years, the state finally decides to speak, out the side of its mouth, through gritted teeth. Silent for years, the state finally decides to speak out the side of its mouth, through gritted teeth. The governor signs a new flag into history. Out the side of his mouth, through gritted teeth, the governor signs a new flag into history. A wearied cheer goes up over the Magnolia State. The governor signs a new flag into history. A wearied cheer goes up over the Magnolia State. One mayor says, time for waiting is over. A wearied cheer goes up over the Magnolia State. One mayor says, time for waiting is over. A new shoot breaks through broken land. One mayor says, time for waiting is over. A new shoot breaks through broken land, a spot of green among a horizon of red. A new shoot breaks through broken land, a spot of green among a horizon of red. The people keep marching forward. A spot of green. Among a horizon of red, the people keep marching forward, the sun at their backs. Not quite a new day. The people keep moving forward. The sun at their backs, not quite a new day, not while so many remain, their stories unspoken.
Thank you so much for that. It's really special to be able to hear someone read something that they wrote because you have a perspective on it that nobody else has yet.
Yes, that's true.
And very few people will have gotten to hear this because your book is released, what, April 6th?
April 9th.
9th.
Yes.
Those divisible by threes numbers. So April 9th, you'll be able to hear the rest of the poems in this collection. Where can people be looking to find it?
You can find it anywhere books are sold. I know it's on Amazon, Bookshop. It'll be at Lemuria. It'll be, if you're in Hattiesburg, you can just find me on the street and ask me, and I will give it to you or sell it to you, I guess. But yes, I think anywhere books are sold in general. I mean, maybe not like Books a Million or
well,
Barnes and Noble, but online anywhere, yeah.
Oh yeah, no, I think it's a very exciting thing to be able to release during National Poetry Month
yes,
too.
Definitely.
I think National Poetry Month is formed in 1996, mm-hmm. So it's almost 30.
Wow. It's going to be complaining about its knees and its bad back.
Well, do you feel celebrated, though?
I do, yes. It's I didn't realize it was 1996, but that makes sense. Yeah. It's nice to have this month where we can really force poetry down people's throats and say, like, listen to us. This is our month.
And love it all the year.
That's right.
It's like the Christmas story. Yeah. Christmas Carol, that one.
Carried in my heart, yes.
Are there any misconceptions about poetry that you kind of want to address with your book or want people to be able to access?
You know, I think there are misconceptions. I think most people experience poetry in high school, and they are probably forced to read, like, William Shakespeare and poets that are mostly writing before, like, the modern period. And maybe you get some, like, T.S. Eliot or William Carlos Williams, and you can, or like E.E. Cummings, and you just mostly, you know, toss that aside and think poetry has to have rhyme, and it has to have, like, a rhythm to it. And if it doesn't do that, then it's not a poem. And what I love, you know, telling people, especially I love showing my students poetry from, like, living authors or, you know, the last 50 years when poetry has had such an explosion of what it can be and what it can do. I think the only sort of limitation that poetry has is, like, what you can think of.
It might be a little strange, but I think I either really enjoy poetry from authors that are currently living or authors that have been dead for centuries, because the ones that have been dead for centuries, if it's still around, it was a universal thing that still probably connects. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I love reading a poem about, you know, staying in too long watching Netflix and not connecting with your family when you should, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, and can you imagine if William Shakespeare had Netflix and what he would have written? Like, probably something incredible.
I feel like most of what's on Netflix is based on the things that William Shakespeare
right.
wrote.
Usually when I'm totally with you there. I love all kinds of poetry, but I, you know, I have a soft spot in my heart for, like, the Shakespeare sonnets, or I love reading John Milton to my students and, like, almost crying, and they're like, what is happening? And I'm like, you don't get it, but it's really powerful.
I love audiobooks of poetry, too. It's a different way to experience it. I almost always have to have a printed version in front of me, but it lets you feel things in a different way.
Yeah, especially when you can hear it in the poet's voice. Like, that makes such a big difference. I think, like, when a poet can really read their poems, like, it just makes the poems feel alive. I showed one of my classes a poem by Jericho Brown, and I was like, oh, I can find a video of Jericho Brown reading this. And I did, and they were like, he's doing too much. And I was like, no, he's like reading the poem the way it should be read. So I was a little disappointed in my students, but I also get it. You know, I'm up here trying to get them to connect with poetry, and they're just trying to figure out what they're going to wear for prom. So.
Well, yeah, you're doing some of the most difficult work out there, which is engaging teenagers who are reluctant.
Yeah.
You know, I think that in terms of, you know, putting out something like this, you're going to need a little recharge time, right? Or are you jumping right back into working on
it? It's funny that you say that. I am kind of jumping back into it because I'm worried that if I don't, it won't happen again. I think that's an irrational fear. But for me right now, my wife and I are expecting in August, which is very exciting.
Congratulations.
Yes, we're so excited about that. It's our first child, so it's going to be great. But I'm kind of like, I need to write as much as I can before this baby comes, so that I have stuff that I can do, you know, in between, like changing diapers and trying to soothe tears.
Well, I'm sure that you'll have, you know, a lot of sticky notes saved from this period that might not make sense to a non-sleep-deprived brain.
I'm sure.
But maybe in 10 years, you'll find the perfect poem for them.
Oh, that's a good thought. Yes, I hope so. I hope that is the case.
How do you hope that this collection will be received by readers? Are there any specific messages or themes that you're wanting to convey?
You know, I think for the most part, if people read the book, that is enough for me. I don't have, like, a goal necessarily. I hope people, like, get something out of it. Like, I hope it is sort of that light that we were talking about, or that mirror that reflects to people and says, like, no, it's okay. Like, sometimes, you know, it is okay to sit with your grief, or to have moments of, like, sadness or loneliness or hope. I know I said there were a lot of poems about the pandemic in here, but most of them try to end on like a hopeful note. And I was talking the other day and saying, like, one of my favorite things is to have a poem that starts off really sad and then sort of hits you with, like, but maybe there's something we can do about it, or like there's some sort of change or hopeful thought at the end.
That so little call to action.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess maybe that's my composition teacher coming in. Like, oh, well, there's a conclusion. And in the conclusion, here's what you can do about it. Yeah.
Well, I think the call to action from our conversation is support live poetry readings and your local Mississippi poets.
Yes, definitely. There's a lot of us. And there's so many poets doing really important, impactful work in the state. So I'm honored to be a part of it.
I think it's fascinating from the perspective of working with so many people across the state through the Arts Commission that, yeah, there really are so many wonderful writers across the state. You've put yourself square into the viper's nest here. Yes. Of competition, but I think it's really amazing to see how this community shapes each other. Mm-hmm. And they help each other grow in their own writing practices.
Yeah.
Has that kind of been your experience?
It's just been really wonderful to sort of like be stepping out onto the stage with the debut and to be met so far with like so much support and community. I couldn't have imagined like a better press in Bellpoint or, you know, place to be publishing right now. Like it all feels sort of like a miracle. It feels, you know, miraculous in that way.
And there's something that I had just in the back of my mind that I wanted to ask you about this collection, and that's the cover. Mm-hmm. I really love this. It's it's striking and also like not overwhelming.
Yeah, this is totally the press. Casey, I think, worked on it, and yeah, I don't. To me, it once again also feels sort of miraculous. It is. Beautiful, and I think it speaks to so many of the themes, something I never would have thought of. Like, I had basically no input, and just one day Casey emailed me and said, which of these options do you like best? And I was like, oh, this one is like the clear winner. And so I'm so happy with the cover. Yeah.
Yeah, it reminds me, I'm very interested myself in illustration, and a lot of times illustrations are in children's books.
Right.
So this reminds me of, it feels like it would be at home in a collection of Oscar Wilde stories.
Oh, yeah.
Like with the selfish giant. And
I can see that.
It feels right. Mm-hmm. For this collection. I think that you really hit something there.
Yeah.
I think that when I was going through and reading and rereading this in advance of our conversation, that one of the things that I really felt strongly was that you're very good at taking something very ordinary and elevating it to the significant. And encouraging people to appreciate what might otherwise have been taken for granted.
Yeah, I appreciate you saying that. That's, I think, one of the great things poetry can do is take something that you had not thought of in a certain way and totally change the way that you think about it. If you think about, like, one of the best tools in a poet's toolbox is a metaphor. And what is that except taking one thing and saying, oh, actually, it's something else. So you do almost this, like, magician sleight of hand where you say, like, oh, you thought I had the ace? This is actually a queen. And that's sort of, one of the things I love about poetry is being able to do that moment where you are able to seed something in a poem, and then at the end it comes back and the reader never sees it coming.
Thanks for listening to this MPB Think Radio podcast. MPB depends on support from listeners, so if you can, please contribute today at mpbonline.org.
Hi, I'm Ryder Taff, Portfolio Manager at New Perspectives, a fee-only financial advisory and co-host of Money Talks. Each week, we take your personal finance questions and tell you about a money topic we hope you find helpful. Money Talks can be heard Tuesdays at 9 a.m. on MPB Think Radio. Podcasts can be found on our website, money.mpbonline.org, or on your smart device's podcasting platform.